Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cohn.
I'm Kevin Beckham.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, and it's great to be back. Sorry it's been a little bit of a long time between podcasts, but I've been very busy running here, there and everywhere. We've got a great show lined up for you as always. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, on this show we have our regular interview, and this week I'm pleased to say we've got John Nienaber, who's the general manager and executive producer at Astro Arena in Malaysia, who I work for. And he's going to be talking just about the place that TV has in sport, how much innovation we're likely to see still with TV. Is there still the money to support sport through TV? And also the problem that they have now when they buy rights and they're seeing so much of those rights being sort of put in jeopardy by other people sort of illegally taking
social
that
media
footage.
Platforms?
Yeah, usually the social media platforms or various other ways of having things done. But that is later in the show.
Well, why don't we sort of start with
Well, just then? Before we do, I just want to go on to one thing because in fact, it's linked to the TV.
Okay.
Because we had, if you remember, on the last show, we spoke to Sam Goodwin.
Yep.
And it was all about marketing and how important the experience is. When you bring in the fans, it's important you give them the experience. Well, I was doing the hockey series finals up in Malaysia, the FIH series finals. And for the first few days, we had Astro were feeding through the TV footage onto a magnificent big screen inside the Bukit Jalil Stadium. So all the fans could see the replays because you know what it's like these days. A lot of people don't keep their eye on the game. And they miss it, so they get to see the replay. Anyway, there were a lot of times where the players on the pitch were then pointing to the umpires and going, look at the screen, look at the screen, because let's remember there was no video referral in this tournament.
Yep.
So then, suddenly, at the end of the tournament, the big screen was just blank. There was nothing on it. And we asked what was the story here, and we were told that the FIH officials at the venue made the decision because the umpires were being put under too much pressure by the players to withdraw the video from the screen. Now, my argument here is, hang on a sec, the umpires have in their pocket, they have cards. If the players are putting undue pressure on them, and we know that there is a rule now for crowding where you can give a card, why did the FIH officials not simply call the team managers together, say to them, listen guys, your players are putting undue pressure on the umpires, this is what's going to happen. If they do this, they're going to get a card. Talk to the umpires and say, guys, you have the cards in your pockets, man up, give them out if you feel you're getting undue pressure. Because what you did there by making that decision, and especially for the final, when Malaysia got to the final and they had a really good crowd, you exactly what Sam Goodwin was saying you shouldn't do, you did. You ruined the experience for a lot of those fans because suddenly, if they missed a bit of the action, they never got a chance to see it. Now, video replays in live grounds now has become pretty much the norm around the world. So to take that down to me was incredibly short-sighted.
I would agree. Having said that, though, it's one of the reasons they brought video referral decisions into sport is because crowds could look up and see things on the big screen happening and then having a crack at the umpires. And a lot of this video stuff was brought in to protect umpires.
Yeah, but the thing is, and that's where football, you have to be fair, because obviously football is very tribal in Europe and South America, they always had a rule, no replays inside the stadium.
Yeah.
So you got to, they'd show a replay of a goal, but they would never show replays of, you know, contentious issues or whatever. It would just be, there's the ball going in the back of the net.
Good on you.
End of it, yeah. Which I think is actually sensible. I think there is a lot of merit in that. But then you're getting into the patch that we were going to talk about, which I think is video referral.
Yeah.
And I actually think when you look at the A-League Grand Final, to me, VAR, get rid of it, never bother, because if you're going to make a cock up like that, and the excuse that was given was it wasn't a big enough, an obvious mistake or something to overrule the original decision. Excuse me? It's either offside or it's not offside. He was not offside, therefore the goal should have stood. It's black and white. simple. But I mean, I actually think, and then there was a comment made by one of the coaches in Malaysia, was they said the problem with the umpiring there was, they said, because suddenly there was no video referral, they said the umpires have kind of eased up because they've always got the fullback of video referral. So when that suddenly wasn't there, they had lost the ability to necessarily make the right decisions or be in the right positions. Now, I'm not an umpire's adjudicator. I'm not an umpire manager or anything like that. So I'm not going to comment on whether they were in the right positions or whatever. This was a comment made by the coaches. But I do believe that sometimes we're now become too reliant and we're not trusting the officials on the pitch to make the right decisions. And I think if we're getting down that path, we're going down a very dangerous path.
Yeah, see, I thought that hockey had a really good system for video referrals. I thought they were leading the pack compared to a lot of other sports. But in recent times, I've changed my mind and I'm starting to wonder whether the sport needs it at all. Attending the games that you commentated here in Perth, the India Test matches, and the other games that weren't televised, no video referrals, players got on with it. I didn't see players, after an umpire blew a decision, running over trying to remonstrate with the umpire. They all just sucked it up and got on with it. Like 99% of the hockey world has to do. We don't get video referrals, most of us.
But isn't that what sport was about? You
exactly.
Get the rub of the green. There are decisions that go against you and there are to be decisions that go your way. And over a career or even over a season, they tend to average themselves out unless you're Manchester United.
And cricket was one of the sports that led globally to the use of video referrals and stuff, video umpires. And that system was set up to get rid of what was called the howler. The one where the bloke swings at the ball, misses the ball by 6 inches, but the umpire gives him out caught behind. They were the sorts of decisions that were set up. It wasn't set up for these ticky touchwood,
yeah,
backwards and forwards, is he outside the line of the off stump or not? Oh, it's fractional. The ball's half across. Now we've got to make up another rule because the equipment isn't actually accurate enough to make, say, that's exactly where the ball is. We have to cut the ball in half. It's got out of hand.
Yeah, cricket, again, for me, like the LBW rule should never be allowed to be in a referral because it's an algorithm that works out where the ball is going, and the ball does not move on that perfect parabola. But the other thing that you have to take into account, and we go back to when video first came into cricket, and you remember there were some really good umpires in the game. There was the David Shepherds of this world. Dickie Bird was still around. I think David Constant was still around. Now, those umpires who had been around the game had all played the game and then were basically really at the top of their game. They were not referring to the video in those days. They were then told they had to. And their argument, I remember this clearly, their argument was, why do we need to when we know we're right? And when they looked at how many times they were wrong, it was very, very rare. And yet they were then pressured into having to use the technology, even though they were good enough that they didn't actually need it. And so, again, I think if you're making people use it, that's wrong.
Yeah.
But then cricket, it's become now such a money spinner. Because as I mentioned, on the big screen now, you get 25,000 people when it's decision pending, and there's a certain white goods brand on the big scoreboard, and, you know, which ironically says life's good, and then you're given out, it's not so good.
You know? No, I get that. I mean, watching the India games, Australia and India, those games didn't lose out because there was no video referral. In fact, they were more entertaining watching the Pro League over the weekend. You know, especially as you get to the end of the game, it's refer, groups of players rushing around an umpire, which I just hate. It irritates me so much to see that happen to umpires.
But I think it also breaks up the game, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah, it takes the momentum totally out of the game.
And I mean, we've seen in some games, and I look at it in commentary, and I think I've commented several times when it's happened. So you have a team that is chasing the game, they're defending, and then suddenly they go on a counter-attack, and the other team, late in the game, will just call for a referral, just to break up that counter-attack. Now, to me, that should be oh, there has to be a penalty because they've prevented the other team from going on the attack deliberately, not really serious about their referral. They'll sacrifice that referral to break up that attack. Now, that shouldn't happen.
And very often, the referral, when you get to a stage where an umpire has to start scrolling backwards and forwards and looking at four or five different angles, it's no longer a howler of a decision.
No, exactly. It tells you how marginal it must have been.
Yeah, and we'll live with it. If you have to start, if you look at it and you can't see immediately from one or two different angles that there's a problem with the decision, that should be it. Go with the umpire. Don't worry about it. Don't go backwards and forwards trying to scroll. And how often do we see it as being indeterminate? You can't, from the vision we're seeing, which I'm told is not the vision that the umpires are seeing, there's no way you can possibly make a decision based on that stuff.
Well, I've always said, and you know, we've had this discussion off air, I'd like to see a time limit put on it. If they cannot make a decision within a certain time frame, you stick with the decision on the pitch.
But honestly, you know, having referrals go
and I'm sure the TV stations would like that because it would mean they would get off air on time or a little bit closer to being on time.
But when things start going for 2 minutes, there's a minute and a half left in the game and they're taking 2 minutes to try and figure out whether it hits someone's foot or not. Hey, yeah, just get on with it, please. It's not entertainment. It is not entertaining. It's boring.
So you're a let's get rid of it.
I think so.
I am too. I'm beginning to err that way.
And not in every sport, but specifically hockey, I don't think we need it. And if you look at other sports that are as dynamic as a game as hockey is, they don't have it.
Yeah, I don't think football needs it either. I think football should just get rid of it now.
A lot of sports just destroys the play too much, and they've realised that, and they just don't have it. AFL football, dynamic game. Hockey would be one of the few games that are actually as dynamic as AFL football. They don't have a video referral. They don't want to destroy the continuity of their contest. They have one for if the ball's crossed the line or if it's touched someone's hand, like a goal referral, but that's not a general play thing. They don't argue to get video referral to get free kicks or shots on goal or anything like that. It's purely about whether the ball has crossed the line in the proper manner.
I
don't know that our sport needs it. Now, I'm sure the umpiring fraternity will come out and say, yes, we do, and I fully understand their arguments for it because they're the ones that cop shit from journalists and fans when their decisions are wrong and then shown over and over and over again by television stations. Maybe we've just got to accept that sometimes umpires make mistakes and it becomes part of the legend of the sport years later down the track. Well, was it? Did it hit their foot or not? You know, those sorts of stories.
And there's plenty of those in the history books and, I don't think there's any harm in them anyway. Well, it's probably time we move on to our guest.
This is Gary Lineker and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. And if you listen regularly, you'll know we always feature one guest on the podcast. And we're very pleased to welcome to the show this time. It is a gentleman I've worked with or for, and that is John Nienaber, who's the general manager and executive producer of Astro Arena up in Malaysia. They are a TV station there. And we're going to talk to him about TV and sport. And I will just warn you, there's a couple of times where it just breaks up a little bit. We apologise for that, but I don't think you'll find it will disturb the interview at all.
John Nienaber, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you, Ashley. Lovely to join you.
No, it's good to finally have you on and be able to have a chat and talk about the sort of TV side of sport. And I was thinking, you know, before I called you, how in my lifetime there have been so many changes. Like I remember when just a replay was a big thing, a new piece of technology in sports broadcasting. But now we've just got so many innovations. Do you think we've almost reached the end of that, or are we still going to see more?
No, I think we're going to see more, Ashley. As you know, you mentioned over your lifetime you've seen many changes, and me also. And having worked in the television industry now for a long time, it amazes me, Ashley, that during my career, I've seen so many changes in the television industry and the way that we go about covering sport. And it's all built around, of course, the fundamentals. There's always a formula for covering sport, and sometimes we tend to adapt or evolve the formula, but it's always we're looking for a baseline, and then we need to grow up with specialty equipment and so on, and new graphics and what have you. But to answer your question, no, I think that we haven't seen the end of it. I think there's more to come. And of course, you know, the advent of 4K, we do know that there's going to be quite a bit of 8K coverage in the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games. So it'll be interesting to see which way that goes. And I turn my mind to 2012 at the London Olympics when, you know, there were some sports that were covered with single camera 8K coverage. And to see that, and so long ago now, 7 years ago, and we still haven't seen that come and bear any fruit in the television industry globally. Certainly in Japan it's occurring, but it's still in its infancy. So I still see that there's going to be growth, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, when you look back again on sport and your involvement, and you, as you said, you've been involved a long time, did you ever think that there would be come a day where sport was so dependent on television's dollars to sort of almost finance it? And do you think that maybe Kerry Packer and World Series cricket was the sort of precursor for that?
Certainly, I think it was a catalyst for change. And, you know, we've seen the result of that change. And we've seen the result of how sport has become more professional, more an industry, built upon the foundations of the money that the sporting bodies attract via rights and ever-increasing rights. And that's for sport that is in high demand. Of course, the ones that attract, you know, millions and millions of eyeballs. Then you've got the second-tier sports that do struggle. And as you know, we could categorise hockey as being a member of that second-tier category. And they haven't been able to attract the same sort of dollars. And, you know, comparing it to what happens in Australia, if you look at AFL, NRL, you know, cricket and so on, attract the big dollar in Australia, then there's everything else. Even the A-League, by comparison, can't generate that sort of revenue for the FA in Australia. And hockey's in the same boat. It's probably a tier down below soccer in Australia. And globally, you know, I think that hockey is finding a new way. Even though it's a very popular Olympic sport, it just seems to, that popularity only kind of becomes apparent, well, to me anyway, around, you know, at Olympic Games.
Do you think, though, that we're going to continue to see television stations bidding for that tier one sports and for that content and still paying the huge prices that they're paying at the moment? Are we going to see that continue?
I think it's plateaued. I think you'll find that the recent EPL deals that were done in the UK, you know, BT and Sky Sports paid less for this right cycle than they did the previous one. Similarly around, you know, this part of the world, which I understand is the second highest after the United Kingdom in terms of the EPL broadcast rights, there's been a contraction. It hasn't actually grown. And that's all due to the governing bodies of the various sports not being able to control, you know, the leakage. And so therefore all of us are suffering in the broadcast industry with quite significant amounts of piracy. And, you know, social media platforms enable people to be able to distribute content that is actually a breach of copyright. Now, quite clearly, that then has a knock-on effect to the broadcasters because, you know, all these deals, the big money deals, they all rely on exclusively wired content. And if that happens to be the engine room that drives those eyeballs and subscriptions and so on, if you take away or you remove that exclusivity, then of course you're devaluing the rights.
No, absolutely. And I mean, how do you combat that though? Because as a TV station, you know, I remember when we had a boxing match here in Australia where people were actually putting their phones on, streaming it off the TV via social media. And I mean, they then were threatened with fines but weren't actually fined. So how are you going to stop, as you call it, the leakage and the devaluing of the product that you've paid big dollars for as a television station?
Well, that's means an answer, Ashley. And I'm not too sure whether your listeners would be aware, but down in Singapore, only a month ago, the Singapore government legislated along those lines to actually make it an offence that if copyright is breached via social media, then penalties, significant penalties, will be applied and it will become a criminal offence. And I think Singapore, the jurisdiction of Singapore, the territory of Singapore, is one of the first in the world to have done it. I do know that the European Union is also either looking at it quite carefully or has very recently proposed to pass legislation to that effect. Now, we all know that, you know, infringement of copyright has been enacted in law for some time. It's just trying to catch up with the, you know, the expansion and that enormous growth of social media and the ability for a consumer to actually, pirate content. And they probably don't think that they're pirating content. They don't think that, you know, on a conscious level anyway, that, you know, by streaming somebody else's content, that they're infringing anyone's copyright. But the opposite is in fact true, isn't it? You know, it is certainly against the law, but, proving it, bringing it to court and having a successful prosecution is the most difficult part. But I do note that I think there was a case with a boxing match over there, which was exclusive to Sky Sports, and one of their subscribers had a party, and someone within that group decided that they were going to stream it on social media live, and in fact that account was then almost immediately blocked, and a fine was issued to the subscriber. Well, actually, the person that was attending, you know, his premises, but the actual subscriber, and it got very, very wide media to the public that these sorts of things weren't going to be condoned going forward. But having said all that, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? Because, you know, around this area in Asia, there are enormous quantities of illegal decoder boxes being sold with hundreds of channels that stream on them for free. Now, whoever is doing it is clearly doing it on an industrial scale, and that's having a big effect. And until such time governments decide that they're going to shut that down and not enable them to be imported into countries and then openly sold, then I think, you know, the problem only kind of gets worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, if you look at the amount of money, though, that television stations and broadcasters put into sport, and the government, if they wake up and realise how much that is and that sum could be cut back unless they police these things, that's probably the only time they're going to actually realise and go, well, hang on a sec, a lot of these sports will fall over without that money. I mean, do you think that it is going to come down to literally the financial nitty-gritty of it before anyone does anything?
Yes, I do. I think that if it reaches a critical mass, then there will be enormous effect. And once it starts to affect the governing bodies of the sport and then flow on to the athletes themselves personally, then, you know, what happens then? I mean, people say, oh, look, I'm entitled to see that. Yeah, maybe they were way back when. But these days, with those enormous rights deals that are done or exclusive content for the exclusive right of covering a particular sport or carrying that sport or an event live, then, you know, the protections have to be in place if they're eroded, like I was saying, and it starts to affect the sport itself. Then what happens? Does it completely implode and then we've got nothing? Do we rely on virtual sport, for example? I don't think so. I think, you know, there's still a huge appetite for, you know, this best sport that can be played by elite athletes, and the public want to watch it. But in these days, if you want to watch it, you have to do one or two things, don't you? You have to be able to cover the cost of those rights and then, you know, the ongoing costs of producing the coverage, or you become a subscriber service in some way. And whether that subscriber service is through direct-to-home satellite, or it's some sort of digital transmission, or it's simply stream, you know, on the internet, is not the point. The point is that ultimately somebody pays somewhere, whether we're paying, you know, in the supermarket with the goods that we buy, and those particular producers pay for advertising on commercial television networks and whatnot, or it's a simple subscriber-based service. And, you know, we're seeing more and more subscriber models enter the market right across industry as well, not just in media and entertainment.
No, we certainly are. And I mean, I think it's interesting that the sort of internet has almost given the public this expectation that they can have what they want, when they want, especially when it comes to sport. And of course, there are some who get very upset about games being geo-blocked. But again, it comes down to if you as a TV station are paying for the rights, producing the rights, you want people to be watching it on your channel and not elsewhere, because you've paid for that privilege.
Correct. Absolutely 100% correct. So if somebody, if we're covering sport for ourselves, and we have an agreement with a governing body, like you say, and that governing body of that sport, that federation, globally has a competing interest in terms of streaming content on their own websites or their own app, then clearly we have to make sure that stream is geo-blocked in our territory where we operate. The point here, I think, is that federations of sport also need to be consider that if they're selling rights to broadcasters, they can't have their cake and eat it too. Now, they can't openly compete and hope to also realise an advantage in terms of the value of the rights that they're selling. So in some instances it works against itself, in others it works quite well. It's getting that balance right. So far, all the federations that we deal with, and we deal with a lot, we seem to have that balance right. And everybody acts in a very ethical way, in terms of my experience in dealing with them. So we have an understanding. I think move into the model where it's enormous sums of money, then of course we're kind of moving into a different zone or a different level. And that has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. But generally speaking, the rule of thumb is if, we're handing over something and there's a reduction in the rights fee because we're paying for the production, or it isn't an entire offset, then, the relationship between the broadcaster and the federation is one where it's a win-win for both.
No, totally understand that. I mean, do you think now, if you look at a lot of the sort of subscriber channels around the world, they have more than one channel. Some of them have, five, six, seven channels all covering sport. Do you feel that we're now almost serving up too much sport, and there is again that expectation that people can watch whatever they want, whenever they want?
Yes, I do. I think, I can cast my mind back to the early days of pay television and made-for-TV cricket events. They were so popular, it was then deemed necessary to create more and more and more triangular series, especially in one-day internationals, for TV, just for the purpose of feeding the beast. Not from the point of view the television broadcaster wants to do that, but certainly the organiser of the event and the teams, because they all get paid more. So it becomes a bit of a pyramid. And you get to a tipping point that whereby maybe you do too much, and then the public just simply become tired and bored with it and start to switch off. And I guess an example of that might be the Big Bash League in Australia at the moment, isn't it? That we had huge success very rapidly, and now it seems to have cooled off somewhat. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's my understanding. Certainly. In the cricket world, there is so much cricket played now. There's channels devoted 24/7 to cricket, channels devoted 24/7 to football, whether it be Aussie rules football or NRL or soccer globally. So yes, the public are expecting to see whatever sport it is that they may want to watch, wherever it is and whenever it is, and as frequently as it can be made available to them. And a lot of them are quite prepared to find a way to circumvent a paywall, and they get it for free. But as I said a while back, somebody has to pay, you know, and television companies can't continue to invest in what's termed to be a loss leader, and hope to then grow, you know, their subscriber base and their commercial activity around it. You know, it has to be, you know, fair exchange, doesn't it?
No, it does. I mean, I could keep talking forever, but we're going to have to probably wrap up fairly soon. But, I mean, again, I was going to ask you there, because it seems that a lot of the public now, they just want to see the game. And are they therefore interested in the quality of the product that they're viewing, or they just want to see the game? And I was just going to ask you, what, in your opinion, makes a good broadcast of a sporting event? What are the key components?
Well, you have to have a full stadium, so you have to have atmosphere. I think you've experienced enough hockey around the world where it's been played in empty stadia, and you know, it might be a good match, but without the atmosphere of the crowd, then it doesn't tend to carry it. So firstly, I'd be thinking that you know, there's got to be a reason for it's got to be played in a full stadium, in a stadium with good facilities, and a high quality event when there is a lot riding on it. Now let's consider, I'll give you a hockey example, the Asian Games, where, you know, you and I were both present in Jakarta last year when Malaysia played Japan in the final for a gold medal, with Japan ranked well below Malaysia. Malaysia expected to win. Malaysia's 5-1 up. It's about 40 minutes to go. About 14 minutes to go, I correct myself. And it ends up Japan winning in a penalty shootout. You know, now, there was everything riding on that particular outcome, because Malaysia was hoping to qualify for the Olympic Games by winning that match. As it turned out, they didn't. And, you know, they're beaten by their competitor, which is ranked lower than them globally, and which also happens to be hosting the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. I mean, you couldn't have a better story, could you? So the stadium was full. The ratings were extraordinary for that particular match. Now, you can't recreate those sorts of circumstances every time that, you know, you play a sport, wherever it might be. But it's those ingredients that become, you know, the big events, the ones that are talked about and remembered for years and years and years, rather than, you know, the preliminary rounds, you know, all the qualifiers and so on. One of the greatest successful sports in the world, even though it's really just one market, is Australian rules football, AFL. I do believe that it's the fourth most watched spectators in the world, which is incredible for a country the size of Australia in terms of population, but hugely successful because people, it's in their DNA. And it's like soccer is in the DNA of the international market as well. So, you know, you do find that when the interest is really, really, really high, but that's been developed over a very, very long time, over generations of people, then, you know, you've built a foundation. And I think that sport that comes along and tries to invent a new, a new way of playing their sport, a simplified way, you know, they're just right. Of some of the other more successful, simply because it's in their DNA.
No, I totally agree with you there. Well, look, John, it's been fantastic catching up with you. We've probably gone on a little bit longer than we normally do, but really interesting points you raise. Thanks very much for your time, and hope to catch up with you again soon.
Thanks, Ashley. Yeah, very good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Hi, I'm Samir Dutt, Olympian hockey player. You're watching on me, not the Footy Show.
Yes,
You're indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and that was John Nienaber, the general manager and executive producer of Astro Arena in Malaysia. And some really interesting points he makes there, John. And I think the biggest one I find there is, as he touched on, the leakage. So as a TV station, when you buy the rights, you obviously buy them because you want to protect those and you want to be the exclusive broadcaster of those, that sporting event or whatever. And it's interesting that Singapore now have brought in a law preventing leakage. So if you are found guilty of actually broadcasting things that you do not have the rights for, there are very, very severe penalties. And as somebody that works in that sphere, I have to say I applaud that. I think it's something that is really needed if we want TV stations to continue to broadcast sport to the highest level.
Have you heard any rumours about there's an upcoming hockey series in finals in Bhubaneswar in India?
Bhubaneswar. You always struggle with that name.
BBI, I'm going to start saying. The rights for that tournament for India have been bought, but the broadcaster has stated they're not going to show the games because they've got other stuff on. Have you heard any?
No, I haven't.
Because it's been going
that
around on Twitter recently.
Okay, no, I haven't actually been across that one.
Oh, well, have a look out for that one. There's a rumour going around that they won't be brought, despite owning the rights, they're not going to broadcast it.
Yeah, look, I think that is an issue, and I think we've seen it as well with a number of sports recently where TV stations have brought the rights. Now, to me, there should be an obligation within, and it's up to then.
I would have thought you write it in your contract.
Yeah, that it's either shown live wherever. But if it's on delay, then I think it should be up to, there must be some form of communication from the TV station or from the national association or international association that advises the punter when it's going to be shown. Because that's the thing that annoys me. When I go to watch something, it's not on. They're going to show it delayed because it's being played in the Northern Hemisphere and they're thinking no one's awake in this part of the world to watch it. But then you can't find when it's on unless you sort of scroll across all the other programs and you've got to try and find over five channels when it's going to be shown. So I think there should be an obligation put in the contract that there is a communication out there as to when this is going to be shown.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And you talk about leakage, etc. I mean, if there's a country on earth where there's leakage, it's India. You can find all sorts of different websites showing all sorts of different sports that they don't have the rights to. Middle, you've got to put up with a few pop-ups, etc. They're horrible coverages, but it's happening, and it's costing television stations money, and it just means they won't pay as much in the future, if they pay anything.
Well, that was it. I mean, we touched on that with John in that interview, and he was saying, you know, how in Asia, they didn't pay, all the TV stations did not pay the English Premier League what they had in the past. And I think you're going to see that those numbers coming down. All those sports that think they're going to continue to get the big bucks, I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to come down big time, and that expectation has to be more realistic.
And people these days aren't sitting on couches in front of 28 centimetres, you know, huge 60 centimetre TVs anymore. They're watching on their phones. They're taking little screens with them wherever they go, and they're accessing it in different ways than they had before, and that traditional media model for television is changing, and it's changing quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing I would say is, I think the newspapers in the main were not ready for the dawn of the internet.
No, definitely.
Very few of them have actually adapted to that new medium and made it work for them. And I think to some extent TV has been caught a little bit short at how fast that medium, the internet and sort of live streaming and all of that has come in and how fast it's advanced. And, you know, we've been doing live streaming here for 6 years now, yeah. I think it was. And we've been amazed how the technology, and we can actually do it cheaper now than we did 6 years ago. So it just shows how the technology has moved on and the quality of what you can do. It's a real problem for TV stations, and it's a real problem for most media outlets.
I mean, for a few hundred dollars, you can go and buy a handheld gyro with a camera on the end of it that you just stand there, and it doesn't matter if you're wobbling or shaking. The machine, the little handheld thing, keeps it all nice. The giant high-definition cameras.
Yeah.
You know, the world ahead for sports broadcasting is just huge as far as the technology goes. The platforms it gets delivered on, well, that's going to be an interesting to see how that develops.
It is. Now, just quickly, we obviously had the A-League Grand Final here in Perth. Yeah, I have to agree with you. It was not a great game. I just got to say one thing. Do we have to Americanize it? Like, I think they called it A-League Grand Final number 14. To me, it was the 2018-19 Grand Final.
Yeah.
It's not A-League Grand Final number 14. That's so American. And maybe because, oh, I don't actually have anything against America, but I just don't like it, please. It's the season that it was in. Because when you call it 14th Grand Final, you don't remember what season it was. Whereas if you call it 2018-19, you go, oh, yeah, that was the season that this happened.
Yeah.
So, to me, it, as a reference point, it's much, much easier to have the year that the competition's being held.
Well, most people, when they're remembering back to things, remember back to, oh, yeah, that was in 2018, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They don't go, oh, yeah, that was season 13, wasn't it?
Okay, well, here's an example. Tell me what was the 20th Olympiad.
The 20th? Oh, was it Los Angeles or Moscow?
I got no idea. I mean, most people go the Olympic year, don't they?
Yeah,
they don't actually refer to the number
of the
Olympic
right.
Games.
Right.
So there's a prime example where it doesn't work.
The other thing about that grand final, we got to penalties. Nil all. 2 hours of boring. I'm too scared to lose this game football. No one should have got that trophy. If you can't score after 2 hours of football, you're not trying hard enough, big fella. You don't deserve to win a premiership. Now, if they had been 3-all or 2-all or even 1-all at the end of full time, sure, go and have your penalty shootout. Neither of you plonkers could even get a goal in a showcase game like a bloody grand final. Should have got to the end of extra time. Don't worry about the penalties. Neither of you deserve it. Either share the prize or no one gets it this year because you don't deserve it. That was such a snore fest, honestly.
No, I agree with you. And I mean, the one thing I think Alex Broskin, I'm sure the FFA hated him for saying it, but seeing as he retired, he goes, well, I'm sorry, I think it should be first past the post. You win the league, you're the champions. And to me, I have always believed that because maybe I'm a traditionalist. I grew up with that system.
You're a football fan.
Yeah, I grew up with that. And it's only in America and Australia where we have that system. And I just think, you know, it is.
But all the other sports that we play have that system.
Yeah.
Have a final system.
Yeah. So why not be different?
Well, see, football is the outlier here, not the other sports. Football's the outlier by saying, oh, we just play a league. And then whoever's at the top of it. Most other sports play some sort of final.
Well, I know
series.
They do. And
so
I
I'm happy that soccer wants to do that.
Yeah, and I actually think there's a place for the finals. But what I'm saying is, and you've played sport, John, all your life. It is very, very hard to end up top of a league ladder. It is a lot of effort to get to the top to be the number one team at the end of the season. And there's a lot of players will never do that in their playing careers. So I just think that needs to be acknowledged. I have no problem whatsoever in having a final series, but to me, the champion will always be the team that finishes top of the league.
In any sport or just
in
football?
Any sport. No, in any sport.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I genuinely believe that because I think it is far harder to be consistent over a whole season and finish ahead of all your opponents than it is to win four or five games at the end of the season.
And it's far more satisfying when a team that's playing down a grade, who's flogged everybody all season and shouldn't be playing in that grade, thinks they're wonderful. Oh, we finished top. Oh, how good are we? Gets beaten on grand final day. There's nothing better than that. And that is a lot harder. That's real hard.
Yeah, look, that's the thing. It's a debate that goes on in every bar around the country.
I've got nothing against football wanting to do that, but the other side of what I'll say is that, okay, maybe this season apart for the English Premier League, most soccer seasons are cooked a month to go. They're boring. After that,
not usually a month, but 2 to 3 weeks maybe. Yeah.
You're killing your league. All that's left is, who's going to get relegated? Let's see who plays the worst football, shall we?
But the thing is, no, it's not who plays the worst football, but the relegation and the promotion from the other divisions really does keep it alive. I think the thing I don't like about the English Premier League now, and I think it's an anomaly that we have a thing called the Champions League, and yet you can come fourth in your league and still play in the Champions League. You're not a bloody champion if you come fourth. And what we're seeing now is teams going, oh, I've just got to make fourth to make the Champions League, or I've just got to come sixth to be in the Europa League. That, to me, is a load of crap.
Yeah.
You know, it should be that you're playing to win the damn league, and that is it. And then maybe those teams, and this is where I'm going to throw something really curly in there. I'm going to say, okay, Man City won the league. The top four teams in England wouldn't play in the Champions League next year. No. What they should maybe do is turn around and say, okay, now the next four teams play off for one place to play in the Champions League.
Yeah.
Because it's not, you're not a champion, and it devalues the league, in my opinion. But again, it was a money grab, get more teams in there, and all the major leagues have more teams, and it was the European strong leagues like La Liga, Serie A, the French League and the English League that kind of got extra teams in there because they wanted them, and it made it more money.
Oh, for a lot of sports too, finals are a cash cow, yeah. A huge cash cow. And the other side of it is that for a lot of sports, they don't play cup competitions at the same time as they have a league competition going on. So effectively for football, the cup competitions that you play in are a sort of, are a replacement for playing finals, if you like.
Correct, yeah.
So you still got some sort of finals thing going on.
Yeah, and the chance for the underdog to knock off the big boy.
That's exactly right.
Well, that's probably it for this week.
Oh, it's social media.
We've got time for that quickly?
Yeah, go on. Very quickly.
All right, very quickly then. This is my theory on the basically born out of the Israel Folau situation. Is I think if you really don't like or don't want your players that are contracted to you as a club to have an opinions, to air those opinions and get themselves in trouble, which is we've seen many, many athletes have gone to Twitter and said things they shouldn't, have had to rescind what they've said, have had to apologise, have been fined, then maybe what you need to do in this modern day world is say, you sign a contract to play for my club, you get rid of your Facebook account, your Twitter account, your Instagram account, and all of those. And you just go, that's the way it is. You don't have those anymore if you're playing for this club. As soon as you leave, you can reactivate them. And I actually think that's better than having the whole circus we've had recently. Because I would allow players to then have more freedom to say what they actually feel. Because I think there's an incredible amount of cowardice on social media platforms where people just say what they think and there is no filter, there is no sort of protection, and that they think they can just use it as a platform to say what they want. Whereas I think if you actually have to verbalise it, a little bit more, the legal side comes in a little bit stronger there because you can't slander people, etc.
Well, I want to know when sporting authorities became the arbiters of morality.
Well, yeah, you know my view on that one. I don't agree with
it
at all.
Just a joke. Honestly, totally. If you don't want people expressing their views on social media, then don't you express your views on social media. Sporting organisations love to pick up on, social causes because it allows them to big note themselves and say to people, look how wonderful we're doing. Look, don't throw your particular sense of morality down my throat. Don't do it. If you're going to tell your athletes not to do it, don't you do it.
Well, you touch on that, and this is something that if you look, very few of the media outlets have actually picked up on, is the whole Israel Folau thing. Now, I'm not condoning what he said. I'm not saying I agree with it. But what you have to look at is who is the major sponsor of the Wallabies? It is our national airline, Qantas. And what has their CEO been a very strong advocate of, which, you know, I actually support gay marriage. I don't have a problem with that. But he, again, is that he was, the sponsor was the one who was really uptight about the comments that were made. So, again, you're getting into a really dirty area. But it's like, if you want to have that, it goes back to your morality. Should a sporting association be feisting their views on people or forcing their athletes to share those views?
If I was Rugby Australia, I'd be more worried about your abilities to govern your sport and run a sporting competition as opposed to trying to dictate to people what they should think. And, you know, ARU, have a good, close, hard look at yourselves and what's happened to your sport under your stewardship.
Well, Rugby Australia now, they're not ARU anymore.
What are they?
Rugby Australia.
Oh, that's because that makes all the difference.
It does, it's huge.
How much did they pay some consultant to advise them to change that name, do you reckon? And that's the sort of crap that I'm talking about that sporting organisations do.
Well, remember we spoke to David Mitchell on that show, exact on this show about that in an earlier episode. If you want to catch that one, look up David Mitchell podcast and tune into One That Before. Well, we've gone on a little bit longer than normal on this one, but we hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back very soon.
See you, mate.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It's in foul.
See ya. We'll be back next week.